The first case in the May 2022 personal injury reversal report is on pages 4 and 5. Vitucci. It's a labor law case. First Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment on his labor law 240 subdivision 1 cause of action. The plaintiff alleged he needed to stand on the rim of a bathtub to install a shower curtain rod. He hit his head and fell when attempting to step up on the rim of the tub. The defendants argued the installation could have been done from floor level. There was no room in the bathroom for an A-frame ladder. The court wrote, "The motion court properly granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff established that he was entitled to judgment by evidence that he suffered harm that flowed directly from the application of the force of gravity when he fell from the edge of the bathtub, which served as the functional equivalent of a scaffold or a ladder. The evidence showed that there was insufficient room inside the bathroom for plaintiff to use an A-frame ladder, and that plaintiff instead was forced to reach the elevated work area by standing on the edge of the bathtub in order to install the shower curtain rods. Plaintiff testified that standing on the edge of the tub was necessary because he otherwise would lack the necessary leverage to tighten the screws with an Allen wrench. In opposition, defendants failed to raise an issue of fact. They rely on an affidavit by their biomechanical expert, Mr. Bove, who opined that plaintiff's overhead reach was sufficient to perform the task while standing on the ground or inside the bathtub. Bove's initial affidavit, however, ignored plaintiff's testimony that he needed the height in order to have leverage to tighten the screws. So, again, here, the plaintiff fell, attempting to stand on the edge of a bathtub to install a shower curtain rod. The majority concluded the edge of the bathtub was the equivalent of a scaffold, and plaintiff's fall was therefore covered under Labor Law Section 240, Subdivision 1. The two dissenters argued the job could have been performed from the ground. Next is Guevara Ayala on pages 5 and 6. The issue here was whether the defendant, a subcontractor, was a liable party under the labor law sections 240 subdivision 1 and 241 subdivision 6. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the 240 subdivision 1 and 241 subdivision 6 causes of action against Swing, that's the subcontractor, the company which constructed the scaffolding, should have been dismissed. Plaintiff fell when, instead of using the scaffold walkway system, he attempted to descend from some scaffolding pipes to the wooden walkway, and a wooden plank broke. The court wrote, "The lower court should have dismissed the Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6 claims as against Swing, the scaffold system subcontractor to the general contractor, because it is undisputed that Swing was not a contractor or owner within the meaning of the statutes, nor was it a contractor or owner's statutory agent. Although it contractually retained the right to re-enter the premises and inspect the scaffold system, Swing did not have any employees on site during the general contractor's work, and it did not inspect the scaffold system while it was in place. For all intents and purposes, once Swing constructed the scaffold system, it returned to the premises only to deliver supplies and to disassemble the scaffold system at the end of the project." So the takeaway here, the subcontractor which constructed the scaffolding from which plaintiff fell was not a contractor or owner, or a contractor's or owner's statutory agent within the meaning of Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 or 241 Subdivision 6. Therefore, the 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6 causes of action against the subcontractor should have been dismissed. Next is Tavares on pages 6 and 7. It's another labor law case, Ladderfall case. This time the issue has to do with indemnification clauses in the relevant contracts. The First Department reversing Supreme Court held the indemnification clause in this Ladderfall case must be strictly construed. The clause stated that the contractor for whom plaintiff worked, Collins, would hold harmless the owner's agent, but did not mention the property owner. Here it was LIC. Therefore, LIC's indemnification action against Collins should have been dismissed. The court wrote, the plaintiff alleged common law negligence, including failure to provide her with a safe ladder, and violations of labor law sections 200, 202, 240 subdivisions 1 through 3, and 241 subdivision 6. LIC, that's the property owner, commenced this third-party action against Collins, who was the contractor that plaintiff worked for, asserting that Collins was obligated to provide plaintiff, its employee, with the necessary equipment to enable her to properly and safely perform her cleaning-related duties at the premises, and that plaintiff's injuries were due to Collins's failure to perform its duties under the contract and provide her with the proper tools, equipment, supervision, direction, and control. The third-party complaint also asserted that Collins agreed to indemnify LIC from any accidents, injuries, claims, or lawsuits arising out of the cleaning-related services Collins provided at the premises. The indemnification provision states that Collins shall hold harmless the owner's agent from all claims by tenants or others whose personnel or property may be damaged by Collins, its operators, and including but not limited to the use of any of the required equipment or material. Tishman is designated as the owner's agent in the contract. LIC is neither identified nor included under the indemnification provision, and the indemnification provision must be strictly construed. So the takeaway here, indemnification clauses in contracts must be strictly construed. Here the contract said the contractor for whom the injured plaintiff worked would hold harmless the owner's agent and did not mention the owner. Therefore, the owner's action against the contractor for indemnification should have been dismissed. Next, on pages 7 and 8, another labor law case, this time dealing with labor law section 200, which is basically a negligence cause of action. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact whether a plywood ramp was a dangerous condition and whether the defendants had constructive knowledge of the ramp. Plaintiff allegedly tripped and fell when carrying a pipe down the ramp. The court wrote, defendants established their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the causes of action alleging a violation of labor law section 200 and common law negligence by demonstrating that they did not have authority to supervise or control the means and methods of plaintiff's work. However, to the extent those causes of action are also predicated on the existence of a dangerous or defective condition, the defective plywood ramp, triable issues of fact remain as to whether the owner or general contractor had actual or constructive notice. Defendants' witnesses all testified to a lack of knowledge of the plywood ramp, thereby establishing lack of actual notice. However, plaintiff raised a triable issue as to constructive notice by his deposition testimony and affidavit that he had seen the plywood ramp in place when he began working at the construction site, although he never traversed it prior to the accident, which occurred months into his work, and that defendants' trailers were located only 30 to 40 feet from where plaintiff's accident occurred. Contrary to the defendant's insinuations, the number of witnesses contradicting plaintiff's account is not a basis for granting them summary judgment. It merely raises issues of credibility for the fact finder. So the takeaway here, the First Department in this Labor Law 200 action noted that a conflict between the plaintiff's testimony and several of defendants' witnesses on the issue of constructive notice of the allegedly dangerous condition which caused plaintiff's slip and fall was not a sufficient ground for granting defendant's summary judgment motion. The conflict merely raised a credibility issue for trial, which is not appropriately determined at the summary judgment stage. Next is Picone, pages 8 and 9. So it's a labor law 240, subdivision 1 cause of action. First Department held that the plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment on the 241 cause of action. Plaintiff fell into an unguarded open manhole. Defendants argued plaintiff's attempting to step over the manhole was the sole proximate cause of the fall. But the fact that the manhole was unguarded, which is another cause of the fall, defeated the sole proximate cause argument. The court wrote, plaintiff established his entitlement to summary judgment on the 241 claim, it being undisputed that he was injured when he fell down an open, unguarded manhole that he had been attempting to cover as instructed while working on a construction site. In opposition, defendants, the operator of the subway facility and its general contractor on the project, failed to raise an issue of fact. Their argument that plaintiff was the sole proximate cause of the accident because he allegedly stepped over the open manhole, at which point he was accidentally bumped by another individual and fell into it, is unavailing given the lack of protective railing around the manhole or any other safety devices. So the takeaway here, a defense to a labor law 241 construction accident cause of action is that the plaintiff's own act or omission was the sole proximate cause of the accident. Here, even if plaintiff's attempt to step over the open manhole was a proximate cause of his fall, the absence of a protective railing around the manhole was also a proximate cause. Plaintiff's comparative negligence is not considered in a labor law 240 subdivision 1 cause of action. Next is Douglas on pages 9 and 10. It deals with the labor law issue and workman's compensation issue and the interplay between the two. The First Department reversing Supreme Court held the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on his labor law 241 subdivision 6 cause of action should not have been granted because it was based upon information raised for the first time in reply. The First Department noted that Supreme Court properly found that the ruling in plaintiff's workers' compensation case collaterally estopped plaintiff from claiming traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder in this labor law action. The court wrote, Supreme Court should have denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment with respect to the labor law 241 subdivision 6 claim, which was based on an expert affidavit submitted in reply. The affidavit, which constituted the first time plaintiff asserted violations of the industrial code, was not addressed to the arguments made in defendant's opposition and instead sought to assert new grounds for the motion. Plaintiff is collaterally estopped from litigating his allegation that he sustained traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder, since the allegation was previously raised and conclusively decided against him in a workers' compensation board proceeding, where plaintiff had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue. So the takeaways here, evidence first presented in reply, and which does not address anything raised by the other party's opposition papers, should not be considered by the court. And a ruling in a workers' compensation case, here rejecting the worker's traumatic brain injury and cognitive disorder claims, may preclude the same claims in a labor law action pursuant to the collateral estoppel doctrine. Next is Redendo on pages 10 and 11, a slip and fall case dealing with whether the plaintiff raised a question of fact about the cause of his slip and fall. The Second Department reversing Supreme Court held defendants did not demonstrate plaintiff could not identify the cause of his slip and fall. The plaintiff fell near a sink in defendant's bathroom. Although he did not see the condition which caused him to fall, his pants were wet after the fall. The court wrote, the defendants failed to establish that the plaintiff did not know what had caused him to fall. The plaintiff testified at his deposition that he did not see the condition that caused him to fall prior to the accident. However, he testified that after he fell, his pants became wet. Contrary to the defendant's contention, this testimony does not establish that the cause of plaintiff's fall cannot be identified without engaging in speculation. So the takeaway here, plaintiff didn't see the condition which caused him to fall near a sink in defendant's bathroom, but his pants were wet after the fall. So the defendants were not entitled to summary judgment on the ground the plaintiff could not identify the cause of the fall. There was circumstantial evidence of the cause. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation. The second verification code for this April-May-June 2022 personal injury update CLE is SLIP. Again, the second verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April-May-June 2022 personal injury update CLE is SLIP. Next is Weiss, pages 11 and 12. It's a defendant's motion for summary judgment in a slip and fall. And because the defendants did not show when the stairway was last inspected prior to the fall, they were unable to demonstrate that they did not have constructive notice of the dangerous condition. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this stairway slip and fall case should not have been granted. To warrant summary judgment on the issue of constructive notice, defendants must show when the stairway was last inspected, which they failed to do here. The court wrote, the defendants failed to show that they did not have constructive notice of the condition that the plaintiff alleged caused her fall. A defendant has constructive notice of a hazardous condition on property when the condition is visible and apparent and has existed for a sufficient length of time to afford the defendant a reasonable opportunity to discover and remedy it. To meet its initial burden on the issue of lack of constructive notice, the defendant must offer some evidence as to when the area in question was last inspected relative to the time when the plaintiff fell. Here, the evidence submitted on the defendant's motion failed to demonstrate when the subject staircase was last inspected relative to the plaintiff's accident. So the takeaway here, in a slip and fall case where the defendant moves for summary judgment, the defendant must show that it either didn't have actual notice of the dangerous condition or it didn't have constructive notice of the dangerous condition. The way the defendant demonstrates a lack of constructive notice is to show that the area was inspected at some time very close to the time of the incident, and they failed to present any evidence on that issue in this case. Next is Pizzolarusso, page 13. It's a case involving a contractor who created may have created a dangerous condition on a public sidewalk and the possible liability of the contractor to a member of the public who was injured on the sidewalk. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's sidewalk repair contractor's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. There was a question of fact whether the contractor who repaired the sidewalk created the hole which caused plaintiff to trip. A contractor may be liable for an affirmative act of negligence which results in a dangerous condition on a public street or sidewalk. The court wrote, a contractor may be held liable for an affirmative act of negligence which results in the creation of a dangerous condition upon a public street or sidewalk. Here, Amato, that's the defendant contractor, failed to establish its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. At his deposition, Victor Amato, Amato's owner, testified that his company had replaced a portion of the sidewalk at the location. He acknowledged that a 2x4 had been installed as a vertical stake to support a form that was used when the concrete was poured and that he or one of his employees would have removed the stake after the concrete had set. The plaintiff testified that she had not seen the hole because from the direction she was walking, it was on the other side of an uneven or sloped portion of the sidewalk. Victor Amato admitted that this slope had been created deliberately through a process known as feathering because the new portion of the sidewalk was at a different height from the existing sidewalk. So the takeaway here, contractors which create a dangerous condition on a public sidewalk or road may be liable to a member of the public who is injured by the dangerous condition. The theory is similar to the launch and instrument of harm theory of contractor liability under the Espinal case. Next is Rodriguez on page 14. It's a fairly rare example of a case at the appellate level where the defendant was found to have successfully demonstrated a lack of constructive notice of the condition which allegedly caused a plaintiff to slip and fall. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant demonstrated it didn't have constructive notice of the presence of a cardboard box over which plaintiff tripped and fell, a rare slip and fall case where a lack of constructive notice was successfully demonstrated at the summary judgment stage. The court wrote, defendant sustained its initial burden of showing it lacked notice of the presence of the cardboard box near the walkway of its building before the accident and that it observed a reasonable cleaning routine. Plaintiff testified that she did not see the box when she left work at 4 p.m. on the day before her fall. And defendant's caretaker stated that it was not there when he left work at 4:30 p.m. on the same day. The caretaker also testified that he cleaned the area twice a day, first thing in the morning and last thing at night. Thus, the box could have been deposited near the walkway a few minutes before plaintiff's accident. Defendant is not required to patrol the area 24 hours a day, and plaintiff failed to show that the cleaning schedule described by the caretaker was manifestly unreasonable. Plaintiff's argument that the caretaker admitted that tenants regularly left garbage near the walkway and that it was a recurring problem is unavailing. The caretaker's testimony shows that defendant was aware of the general problem, not that it was aware of the specific presence of the cardboard box at issue, and that it addressed the problem by having the caretaker clean the area twice a day. So the takeaway here, in this slip and fall case, the defendant at the summary judgment stage presented evidence including the plaintiff's deposition testimony which demonstrated the box which allegedly caused plaintiff's fall was not in the walkway long enough to raise a question of fact whether the defendant was or should have been aware of it. Next is Colin on page 15. It's a slip and fall case that deals with the storm in progress rule. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the property owners, that's Site A's, motion for summary judgment in this ice and snow slip and fall case should have been granted. The evidence demonstrated it was still snowing at the time of plaintiff's fall, and plaintiff did not submit an expert affidavit demonstrating how defendant's snow removal efforts exacerbated the condition. The court wrote, Site A made a prima facie showing of entitlement to summary judgment based on the storm in progress doctrine because the meteorological data, its expert meteorological affidavit, and plaintiff's deposition testimony annexed to its moving papers established that there was a storm in progress when the accident occurred. Although the burden shifted to plaintiff to establish that Site A created the alleged condition or made it more hazardous by attempting to remove the precipitation from the driveway about 5 hours before he fell, plaintiff failed to meet that burden as he submitted no expert affidavit explaining how Site A, by not salting or sanding the area before the accident, could have created or exacerbated the naturally occurring ice condition. So the point here, in this ice and snow slip and fall case, the defendant property owner presented prima facie proof that the storm in progress doctrine applied because it was snowing hours before plaintiff fell and was still snowing when plaintiff fell. The burden shifted to the plaintiff to show that defendant's snow removal efforts, undertaken hours before the fall, exacerbated the dangerous condition. Because plaintiff didn't submit an expert affidavit on that issue, plaintiff's burden of proof was not met. Next is Chowdhury, pages 16 and 17. This is a highway design traffic accident negligence case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the negligent roadway design cause of action against the city should not have been dismissed in this traffic accident case. Plaintiffs alleged the absence of turnouts for disabled vehicles on Harlem River Drive created a dangerous condition. The court wrote, defendants failed to establish that they were unaware of dangerous highway conditions on the northbound Harlem River Drive where the decedent's accident occurred, or that the previous accidents in that area of the drive disclosed by the record were not of a similar nature to the decedent's accident, or that the causes of those accidents were not similar to the alleged design-related causes of the decedent's accident. In or about 1983, the city had received a study recommending that shoulders be added to this section of the Harlem River Drive, and even the city's engineer admitted that the absence of a shoulder or other place of refuge created an unsafe traffic condition. The record in this case discloses that at least 11 more motor vehicle accidents occurred on the Harlem River Drive between 165th and 183rd Streets between October 1990 and September 1993. That were related to disabled vehicles in the travel lanes that could be directly attributed to the drive's lack of shoulders. The record also reveals that the city had justified its inaction by minimizing the significance of pertinent accident data, suggesting that the safety benefit of adding shoulders or turnouts to the Harlem River Drive would be outweighed by the onerousness of the undertaking and estimating a multi-million-dollar cost of the endeavor. A municipality breaches its non-delegable duty to keep its roads reasonably safe when it is made aware of a dangerous highway condition and does not take action to remedy it. So the takeaway here, where the municipality or the state has undertaken studies which conclude a roadway design, here the absence of turnouts for disabled vehicles created a dangerous condition, the city or the state will be liable for an accident caused by that dangerous condition. Next is Colt on pages 17 and 18. It's an interesting traffic accident case because it involves sovereign immunity. A bus owned by the New Jersey Transit Corporation, which is an arm of the state, struck a New York resident in New York. And the question was, where can plaintiff sue? The First Department, over an extensive two-justice dissenting opinion, held the doctrine of sovereign immunity did not require the dismissal of plaintiff's suit against the New Jersey Transit Corporation in this bus pedestrian accident case. Plaintiff was struck by the New Jersey Transit bus in New York. The plaintiff, under New Jersey law, could not sue in New Jersey because the cause of action did not arise in New Jersey. The First Department held that the forum non conveniens criteria provided an appropriate analytical framework. The court wrote, we have previously held that New Jersey Transit Corporation is an arm of the state of New Jersey, and that as such, it is entitled to invoke the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Should we dismiss a personal injury action on the ground of sovereign immunity when the action cannot be commenced in the sovereign's own courts because the injury arose outside of the sovereign's borders? We resolve this issue by analogizing it to the legal framework for the forum non conveniens doctrine. Among the factors to consider in determining whether to dismiss an action under this doctrine, with no single factor controlling, are the burden on New York courts, the potential hardship to the defendant, the availability of an alternate forum in which the plaintiff may bring suit, the residency of the parties, the forum in which the cause of action arose, and the extent to which the plaintiff's interests may otherwise be properly served by pursuing the claim in New York. So the takeaway here, a bus operated by the New Jersey Transit Corporation struck plaintiff in New York. New Jersey Transit is an arm of the state of New Jersey to which the sovereign immunity doctrine applies, but under New Jersey law, the suit cannot be brought in New Jersey. After analyzing the case using the forum nonconvenience criteria, the First Department allowed the New York lawsuit to go forward. Next is Keys on pages 18 and 19, another traffic accident case. And the prominent issue in this case is the Graves Amendment, which relieves the lessor of a vehicle from liability for the driver's negligence. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff did not demonstrate the Graves Amendment did not apply to the owner of the vehicle involved in the accident, relieving the owner of a leased vehicle of liability. The court wrote, pursuant to Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 388, every owner of a vehicle used or operated in this state shall be liable and responsible for death or injuries to person or property resulting from negligence in the use or operation of such vehicle, in the business of such owner or otherwise, by any person using or operating the same with the permission, express or implied, of such owner. However, pursuant to the Graves Amendment, which preempts conflicting New York law, the owner of a leased or rented motor vehicle or an affiliate of the owner cannot be held liable by reason of being the owner of the vehicle or an affiliate of the owner for personal injuries resulting from the use of such vehicle if, one, the owner or an affiliate of the owner is engaged in the trade or business of renting or leasing motor vehicles, and two, there is no negligence or criminal wrongdoing on the part of the owner or affiliate of the owner. That's a federal statute, 49, United States Code, Section 30106, Subdivision A. Takeaway here, if the owner of a leased vehicle is not negligent, for example, for improper maintenance of the vehicle, the Graves Amendment relieves the owner of liability for a traffic accident involving the leased vehicle. Here, the plaintiff did not demonstrate the Graves Amendment didn't apply. Therefore, the burden to prove the amendment did apply never shifted to the defendant vehicle owner, and plaintiff's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. Next is Lindo on pages 19 and 20. It's an intersection traffic accident case, and it stands for the proposition that if the driver violates Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1141, by making a left turn in front of an oncoming car when that car is so close as to constitute an immediate hazard, that's negligence per se, and the driver of the car making the turn is negligent. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case should have been granted. Plaintiff was a passenger in a taxi cab when the cab collided with the Katz defendant's vehicle, which was making a left turn in front of the cab. The court wrote, pursuant to Vehicle and Traffic Law 1141, the operator of a vehicle intending to turn left within an intersection must yield the right of way to any oncoming vehicle that is within the intersection or so close to it as to constitute an immediate hazard. A violation of the statute constitutes negligence per se. Here the evidence submitted by the plaintiff, which included the deposition testimony of Gabriel Katz as to the happening of the accident, established that Gabriel Katz was negligent in making a left turn when it was not safe for him to do so in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law Sections 1141 and 1163, and this negligence was a proximate cause of the collision. While there are some discrepancies between the deposition testimony of the plaintiff and Gabriel Katz as to the relative position of the vehicles at the time of the impact, even under Gabriel Katz's account, he was negligent in attempting to make a left turn when the turn could not be made with reasonable safety. In opposition, the CATS defendants failed to raise a tribal issue of fact. Contrary to their contention, the evidence did not support the possible applicability of the emergency doctrine under the circumstances. So the takeaway, a left turn in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1141, is negligence per se. Next is Blake, pages 20 and 21, another left turn accident case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case should not have been granted. Although plaintiff was making a left turn when he was struck by defendant in the oncoming lane, there was a question of fact whether defendant should have seen the plaintiff. Plaintiff was making the turn after a stopped driver in the oncoming lane gestured to him. The court wrote, although the defendant submitted evidence that the plaintiff failed to yield the right-of-way when turning left in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1141, the defendant failed to establish that the plaintiff's failure to yield was the sole proximate cause of the collision and that the defendant was free from fault. While testifying, the defendant admitted that he saw nothing out of the ordinary prior to the collision, that he could not recall if he observed the plaintiff's vehicle, and that he only realized that there was a collision from hearing the sound. However, the defendant also testified that he was only driving at approximately 25 miles per hour and was looking straight ahead on a sunny afternoon with no obstructions to his view. The defendant acknowledged that he did not know if his vehicle or the plaintiff's vehicle entered the intersection first. The defendant's evidentiary submissions failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether the plaintiff's vehicle was already in the intersection as the defendant approached, and whether the defendant should have observed plaintiff's vehicle making a left turn in time to take evasive action to avoid the accident. So the takeaway here, although plaintiff may have violated the vehicle and traffic law by making a left turn in the path of defendant's car, there can be more than one proximate cause of an accident. Here there was a question of fact whether defendant should have seen the plaintiff as he attempted to turn. Next is Newman, pages 22 and 23. It's a negligent hiring case against a hospital whose employee, a doctor, sexually assaulted patients. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff who, along with other patients, was allegedly sexually assaulted by a doctor named Newman, employed by the defendant hospital, Mount Sinai, was entitled to certain discovery. Plaintiff sought discovery of party statements, incident reports, the identities of the other assaulted patients, and the names of the doctor's co-workers at the time of each assault. Plaintiff was entitled to documents not protected by the quality assurance privilege. The doctor-patient privilege did not extend to the identities of the other assaulted patients, and the names of the doctor's co-workers were in a statement prepared by the Health and Human Services Department to which plaintiff was entitled. The court wrote, we reject Mount Sinai's assertion that privilege excuses it from complying with plaintiff's discovery demands regarding the identities of the other three patients that defendant Newman assaulted. The doctor-patient privilege provided for by CPLR 4504 subdivision A protects information relevant to a patient's medical treatment, but the privilege does not cover incidents of abuse not part of a patient's treatment. Moreover, while the court stated that disclosure would violate HIPAA, federal regulations provide for disclosure of HIPAA-protected documents subject to a showing that the party seeking disclosure has made a good faith effort to secure a qualified protective order, and plaintiff has done so in each of her motions. The identities of defendant Newman's co-workers at the time of each of the assaults are relevant and must be disclosed, as those co-workers may have information concerning his conduct. The names of the co-workers were contained in a statement of deficiencies prepared by the Department of Health and Human Services, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and plaintiff is entitled to production of that statement, redacted to remove conclusions of law and opinions of the Department of Health and Human Services. So the takeaway here, plaintiff was allegedly sexually assaulted by a doctor who pled guilty to assaulting other patients. Plaintiff sued the hospital which employed the doctor under a negligent hiring and retention theory. The names of the other assaulted patients were not protected by the physician-patient privilege. Party statements were not protected by the quality assurance privilege, and plaintiff was entitled to the names of the doctor's co-workers. Next is Vasquez. It's the final case in the May 2022 personal injury reversal report. It's a products liability case. Plaintiff's thumb was severed by a router. The First Department, modifying Supreme Court in this products liability case where plaintiff severed his thumb using a router, held 1. The failure to warn cause of action based upon the product manual should have been dismissed because plaintiff testified he never read it. 2. The generalized failure to warn cause of action properly survived summary judgment. And 3. The design defect cause of action alleging the router should have had an interlock device which would have shut it down properly survived summary judgment. Where plaintiff was familiar with the risk of amputation such that the defendant was relieved of the duty to warn is a question of fact, and whether the lack of an interlock device is a design defect is a question of fact. And this is the First Department disagreeing with decisions from the Second Department. The court wrote, the record contains evidence that plaintiff had knowledge of power tools other than the router and the general hazards associated with cutting devices. Plaintiff also had used the router on one prior occasion at the premises before the accident. However, it is for the jury, not the court, to determine whether, based on the evidence and testimony presented, plaintiff had sufficient knowledge of the specific hazards from the use of the router to relieve defendants of their duty to warn of them. Further, whether the router presented an open and obvious danger is also a jury issue. The branch of defendant's motion for summary judgment dismissing the design defect claim based on the lack of an interlock was also properly denied. The takeaway here, in this products liability case where plaintiff lost a thumb using a router, there was a question of fact whether plaintiff was familiar enough with the danger of amputation that the defendant should be relieved of liability for the failure to warn. And here, the First Department, disagreeing with the Second Department, held that the absence of an interlock device which would have shut the router down raised a question of fact on the design defect cause of action. And that concludes the decision summaries in the May 2022 personal injury reversal report, and we will now move on to the June 2022 personal injury reversal report.